Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. These days, when you set up house, it's a given that after you buy the bed, you buy the grill. Makes sense. And since we're all so confident about firing up, let's spread those wings. How about some new ethnic grilling? Today we have grillmeister Stephen Reichlin, author of the barbecue Bible, Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. Jane and Michael Stern are in fried chicken heaven. Technically, that's the state of Kentucky. Gadget Queen Dory Greenspan takes on cheese graters. We have reports on France's latest home cooking trend, frozen food. Top chefs open their kitchens to amateurs. All this and more coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today I'd like to talk about the pastas of summer. I've got some ideas for quick saucing without meat, some strong opinions about pasta salads, and a new trick for getting more flavor from your fresh pasta toppings. This is definitely the best time of year to make uncooked or barely cooked sauces. You get this lovely play of textures and temperatures when you toss hot, fresh-cooked pasta with a room-temperature raw sauce like tomatoes, basil, garlic, and olive oil. But first, let's get one important issue out of the way. Pasta salads don't exist in Italy, probably for good reasons. Italians have experimented with just about everything you can do with pasta. They found cold pasta just doesn't taste good. Sure, they serve pasta at room temperature, but once you refrigerate it, something goes very, very wrong. It doesn't taste right. Now, what most Italians say about our tortellini salads cannot be repeated on the public airwaves. Okay, enough of that. Let's talk summer pastas. The rule is, make the sauce ahead, cook the pasta the last minute. Here's some thoughts to spur your imagination. These aren't recipes, they're ideas. The first one is the great classic, tomato, basil, garlic. There is nothing like this one. Take a deep bowl, it helps keep the pasta warm, rub it with garlic, dice in good-tasting tomatoes, skins, seeds, and all. Tear some fresh basil over them, toss with olive oil, salt, and pepper to taste. Cook up pasta. I love spaghetti. Toss everything together and blend with cheese if you want, but it's not vital. Okay, now once you've mastered the tomato sauce, there's a trick to know. Uncooked sauces, especially tomato sauces, throw off liquid. You can bring more flavor to the dish by cooking that liquid into the pasta. Here's how. Stop cooking and drain the pasta when it's just a little firmer than you'd like it. Spoon the juices from the sauce into the pasta pot. Set it over medium heat, put the pasta back in the pot, and toss it for a few moments until the juices are absorbed. Then add that to the sauce in the bowl. It's going to taste absolutely sensational. On to streetwalker's pasta, puntanesca in Italian. Supposedly, this was the pasta that streetwalkers could toss together easily between business appointments. Improvise with this one. You can blend olives, garlic, hot pepper, capers, onion, tomato, and even anchovy if you like it. Toss everything with the pasta. Usually there's no cheese with this one. From spicy pasta to a sauce chock-a-block with summer herbs. Make what one farm woman I met in central Italy called her chopping board sauce. Chop all together at the same time a blend of fresh herbs. A pile of basil, oregano, mint, thyme, chives, parsley, and cut that all up with red onion and garlic. Toss the mixture with hot linguine, olive oil, and a finishing touch of toasted pine nuts and crushed almonds. Shavings of Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese are really great here. My last idea is a sweet and hot pepper sauce with chickpeas. You roast sweet and hot peppers together. You could do this over the grill if you wanted. And if you want to, you could peel them or just chop them up. Meanwhile, marinate some chickpeas, red onion, garlic, and oregano in lemon juice. Toss everything with a stubby pasta, like penne, you know, the one that's shaped like little hollow tubes. Add olive oil to taste and maybe some fresh-tasting young sheep cheese, like the kind that's called ricotta salata. You can find it in a lot of supermarkets these days. So, there you have some quick summer pastas. A classic tomato sauce, a spicy streetwalker's sauce, fresh herbs with pine nuts, almonds, and garlic, hot and sweet peppers with chickpeas, and a trick for boosting flavor. For more good eating, join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. These days, the grill is as necessary as the bed or the TV. Even people who don't think they cook grill, which is why today we thought we'd expand our repertoire. The burgers and brats and fish fillets are fine, but how about some grilling from Brazil or Turkey or maybe Vietnam? It's the Ethnic Grill with our guest Stephen Reichlin. He's been to all of those places and many more, gathering grilling recipes and techniques. He's the author of the Barbecue Bible, Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. We've dubbed Dory Greenspan our gadget queen. She's an award-winning cookbook author who loves to put gadgets to the test. Today, it's cheese graters. Now, we all know that France is Mecca when it comes to superb food. So, why are frozen food shops booming all over Paris? We have a report from our Parisian correspondent. On the other side of the French coin, top chefs in France and America are opening their kitchens to amateur cooks. They're giving cooking lessons. We'll have more on this one. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with our favorite road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet magazine.
We have been in Kentucky, and you know, Kentucky is very serious about its fried chicken. That's where Colonel Sanders started. But we found some incredible fried chicken in Henderson, Kentucky. Donna King at the Bon Ton Mini Mart told us about it.
Our fried chicken, okay, it originated in 1972. The owner was Bill Coe. Bill K-O-C-H was his name. And I worked for these people for 11 years. They were killed 3 years ago, all except one daughter. The whole family was killed. So I flew to Vegas and got the recipe and brought it back and started using it here again. I was really doing it to help her and keep her daddy's memory alive because he worked his heart out on that chicken when he was alive.
I know you can't give away your deep, dark secrets of exactly what's in the chicken, but what's different about this chicken than regular fried chicken?
I think the most thing is where we marinate it in a certain seasoning for 24 hours. It marinates, and then we got a seasoning that we mix in the flour before we bread it. And then once we bread it, we let it set up in dough. You know, get doughy before you cook it, or it doesn't have the same flavor as if you just bread it.
Lynn, this is a very sad story, but it's really a culinary memorial to a guy who probably made the best fried chicken in the whole state of Kentucky.
What does it taste like?
Whoa, what does it taste? That it's as hard to describe this chicken as it is to describe the taste of country ham, which it kind of resembles in the sense that it's very salty. It really packs a punch, and your first impression when you bite into it is, wow, is this salty? But then comes a tidal wave of kind of salty, chickeny, marinated flavor that is not to be believed.
I mean, I've made fried chicken all my life, and I always heard that the secret of good fried chicken is you dip it in either, you know, egg or milk, and then you quickly dunk it in flour and fry it right away. Mm-hmm. And when Donna King told us that Bill Coe, which is a whole, I mean, we Easterners would pronounce his name Bill Koch, but down there it's pronounced Bill Coe, not Sergeant Bill Coe, Colonel Bill Coe, that his secret was to dip it in the flour and then let it just sit and get doughy. And I thought, no, this can't be. It's going to taste like a, you know, a wad of, you know, dough. Well, I'll tell you, it is truly the most exceptional fried chicken. And what happens is, rather than the crust falling off, letting the flour sit and soak into the chicken kind of adheres it to the chicken. So when it fries, it just is this extremely light, flavorful crust that stays on the meat.
And the meat itself is extraordinary because of that overnight marinade. I mean, so it's just profoundly moist inside. I mean, sort of falling apart moist, and yet just packed with chicken flavor like you can't believe. And what's fun about this place is that it really is a little, it's a former mini mart, the size of a little convenience store with only a few tables, and they only have enough buckets to do a certain amount of fried chicken every day. So if you get there at maybe 1:30 in the afternoon, they might be out of fried chicken.
You know, for all of the years Michael and I have been on the road, this Bon Ton Mini Mart in Henderson, Kentucky, unless one of our road food readers clued us in on it, I have to confess, we would sail right by. It just looks like, you know, any old convenience store. There's nothing interesting about it until you go inside, and then it is really a shrine to individuality. Donna King has painted it sort of bordello pink inside. Everything from the scalloped apples to the homemade sheet cakes are, you know, just perfect square meals, home cooking. And the labor intensiveness of this fried chicken, it really takes her 24 hours to make each batch.
This really sounds incredible. The best fried chicken in Kentucky. Hey, you two, thank you.
And that's saying something. Bye, Lynn.
Happy eating.
That's the way to begin. H, that's the next letter in.
Gene and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them here every week with a new report, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks and loves to test out gadgets. She has a column in Bon Appetit magazine called Tools of the Trade, and she stops by the Splendid Table to share her discoveries on a regular basis. Dory, hi.
Hi there.
Dory, last night I went to grate my parmigiano with my old cheese grater.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened that happened all the time. I mean, bloody knuckles.
So unattractive, yes, with white cheese. So
very
painful.
Bad. Very bad. So, you know, have you ever dug into cheese graters?
Do you think dug in is the right word?
Well, this is really what's on my mind these days. Really?
Actually, yes. And it's funny. I own four different kinds of cheese graters. Of course. And I think of these cheese graters as representing a kind of mini history of my culinary life. Because I started cooking with my first cheese grater, which was a rotary grater. Is that the kind you couldn't have done your knuckles in on a rotary
grater? No. It was this sort of thing you tilt. But anyway.
Well, the rotary grater, do you know what they're? It's a little cylinder that has the grating holes on it and a little side crank attached to it. And it sits in a cradle that's a handle. And you put the cheese in a little box on top of it. And I'm playing with one now. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Clunk down the top. And then you just turn the side crank and the cheese comes out.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. They're called moulies, aren't they?
Actually, it's because they're made by the Mouly Company, among others. And mine's a Mouly grater. And I bought it when we first got married. It was my very first grater. Probably not the most practical grater to start with, but at that time, it was the most exotic grater I'd ever seen. And exotic meant a whole lot more than practical.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, you know, it was just fine. It's still fine, except it wasn't fine the first time I used it, because I tried to do mozzarella cheese in it.
So what happened?
Ooh, sticky, gummy mozzarella clogged up the holes. It's when I realized that the thing about grating cheese is you need to match the grater with the kind of cheese you're grating. And the rotary grater is terrific for hard cheese. It would have been fabulous for your Parmesan cheese last night.
Right, right.
And it's also good for small quantities of cheese because you keep turning. When I spent 15 minutes cleaning out the gummy mozzarella from these holes, I realized, you know, that's why people own box graters and have ever since, who knows when. I mean, our grandmothers had box graters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the really old-fashioned kind, four grating sides, opened at top and bottom with a little handle. And, you know, they're so old-fashioned, but they really do work. The large holes are fine for soft cheeses like the mozzarella.
Mm-hmm.
The tiny holes are good for hard cheeses. Then there's a slicing blade. And this really, it's good, it's inexpensive, and it's really a terrific thing to have on hand. It's also not bad for cucumber salad.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
These days, you know, I find I'm less likely to grab either the rotary or the box grater. I have something that I think of as my box on a box. It's a grater that's on a slide upon.
And what?
Well, it's on a wedge. I think of it as a slide upon. It's on a wedge-shaped wooden box. It's very beautiful. It's Italian. It's wood. It's expensive, but it comes in a less expensive plastic model. And the grater just fits on the slide upon part of this wedge-shaped box. You grate your cheese. The cheese falls into the box. It is for people like me who are not congenitally neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally
mm-hmm.
neat. And it's made, they now make them in, over a bowl so that the grater fits on top of the bowl. Grate your cheese, goes into the bowl, and if you have to keep your cheese for a little while, you can keep it right in the bowl or the box.
Can I do soft and hard cheeses on that?
Yes, because you can get graters with different size grating holes for this.
Ah, okay. All right.
It's a very attractive, it's very neat, but I have to tell you, I have recently fallen madly in love, and I am now a one grater woman. I have given... There's another one. I have given my heart to the microplane grater. The microplane grater looks like a woodworker's rasp. These look like tools. And in fact, the microplane company made woodworking tools and continues to. And I may be making this story up, but I think it goes that a woman called the company and said, you know, I have taken my husband's rasp and I have been grating lemon zest on it. And it's fabulous. You should go into the home grater biz. And in fact, this is what they have done. And they make graters with tiny little holes and then graters with larger holes. They're laser cut. They're laser sharp. And, you know, it's turned me into a grating fool. The other day, I had gone over the bend when I was making grilled cheese sandwiches and insisted on grating the cheese for the... It's just, it taken my heart. These are really fabulous graters. They're available in Williams-Sonoma has them for about $15 or $16. And a company, I just noticed this last week, a company called Queasy Pro has taken the grater part and put their own little housing on it.
Uh-huh.
And they make fine and coarser grates. They're fabulous.
Dory, thank you. Only a food person could come up with four necessary graters.
Hey. Must have. Must have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Dory Greenspan is co-author of Danielle Ballou's Café Ballou Cookbook. Her Tools of the Trade column appears monthly in Bon Appetit magazine.
You can get Dory's cheese grater picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Grillmeister Stephen Reichlin with grilling ideas from around the world, the latest French food trend, frozen, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. These days, when you move into an apartment, you buy a bed, and then you buy a grill. At a party recently, a woman said, "I don't cook, but of course I grill." Now, my theory is that grilling is much less intimidating than day-to-day cooking. So, since we're so confident, I want you to branch out. Let's see how the rest of the world grills. Our guest, Stephen Reichlin, is a master chef who's also a grilling expert. He's roamed over five continents collecting recipes. His latest book is The Barbecue Bible, Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Lynn.
Look, Steve, you've been all over the world researching barbecue and grilling. I would like to focus on the places that we rarely think about as being centers for grilling and barbecuing, okay?
Okay.
And, you know, sort of ethnic sauces.
Well, one great place to start might be Morocco. You know, people are becoming more familiar with Moroccan food. They think of tagines and stews, but Moroccans are great grillers, and they make something called meshoui, which is a whole grilled lamb. And it's sauced with two very interesting condiments. One is called charmoula. And it's kind of a vinaigrette that's flavored with fresh parsley and coriander and cumin and hot pepper flakes. And the other is harissa, which is a Moroccan hot sauce. And again, garlic, cumin, hot chili peppers. And these two sauces work in such great harmony together. Hot and then aromatic.
Now, are they put on the food, or are they, you know, as it's cooking, or are they used at the table afterward?
They're used at the table. The Moroccans are really pretty simple in terms of seasonings on the food. Melted butter would be used as a base, maybe a sprinkling of salt, pepper, and cumin. And you're also served a little dish of salt and a little dish of ground cumin with your barbecue, and you take a pinch of each. It's a really lovely combination.
Well, that sounds good. That sounds really good. What about some other places? I mean, for instance, does anybody throw a shrimp on the Barbie in the Soviet Union? I just don't think of grilling in the former Soviet Union.
Well, you might be surprised, but the Republic of Georgia, which lies next to Turkey, is a great place for grilling. In fact, it's believed, at least in mythology, that grilling originated here.
It is said You're
that
kidding.
Prometheus gave man the gift of fire in the Caucasus Mountains, and that is the Republic of Georgia. Georgians are great fans of grilling. In fact, when the French writer Alexandre Dumas was there, he used to use the ramrod from his rifle, and he would use that as a spit for doing impromptu barbecues on the side of the road. But the Georgians have a wonderful sauce that's called tekmali, and it is a sour fruit sauce. Now, this may sound a little strange until you think about American barbecue sauce, which is a little sweet and a little sour.
Uh-huh.
To make tekmali, the Georgians either use a small sour tekmali plum, Or the version that I have in the book is actually a rhubarb tikkamali, where you use rhubarb and it's stewed with garlic and fresh dill and coriander. And you make a thick, it's almost a paste, and you just put a little dab of that on a grilled game hen or grilled lamb. It's absolutely delicious.
That really sounds great. So Prometheus delivered the fire, and the first thing they did was they stuck a
make a barbecue
lamb.
Sauce.
They
That's
made
right.
a barbecue. Okay. I can, this is mythology I can really understand.
Uh-huh.
What about Africa?
While charcoal is the preferred fuel, cooking fuel, for uh-huh. vast stretches of Africa, in many parts of Africa, it's used to heat a stew pot rather than actually to heat a grill. Now, one great exception to that rule, you find a lot of grilling in North Africa around the east coast of Africa. The west coast is primarily a stewing culture.
Uh-huh.
But South Africans are great fans of grilling. They call their barbecues braais. And they have a really interesting sauce that's called a monkey gland sauce. Now, before your listeners panic, know that this is not a sauce that's made out of primate parts. Rather, it's I guess it's their version of barbecue sauce, and it's made with fruit chutney that you thin down with red wine and port, and then you spice up with a little hot sauce and butter. And it's a wonderful kind of a sweet, plummy. It's a great sauce for beef. It's a great sauce for wild game, poultry.
But why do they call it monkey gland?
You know, I have never been able to find an explanation for that, and I've asked plenty of authorities, cooking authorities in South Africa. Nobody, people just scratch their heads on that one. It's a little like chimichurri, the great Argentinian steak sauce, which is a sort of a cross between a pesto and a vinaigrette. It's a puree of fresh flat leaf parsley, garlic, olive oil, and vinegar. It's a wonderful sauce for grilled beef, and nobody can explain to me why it's called chimichurri.
Huh. Let's go to the Pacific Rim. What are some of your favorite discoveries there?
Well, you know, I think Korea is probably the best-kept dining secret in general, and especially barbecue secret specifically in Asia. And the Koreans have a very interesting barbecue sauce. It's a sweet, salty dip like you find throughout that part of the world. But the unusual ingredient here is diced Asian pear, which gives this dip a kind of a unexpected, succulent, moist, kind of sweet, peary crunch. And when you try that with grilled beef, wow, it's sensational.
That sounds... So the pear is actually diced into, what is it, a soy-based sauce?
Yes. If you can imagine, it's equal parts soy sauce, rice wine. There's a little sesame oil for a nutty flavor. There's a little honey or sugar for sweetness. Obviously, you have your garlic, your scallion, your sesame seeds. And then you bring this crisp, crunchy, diced Asian pear in.
Mm.
And it's really interesting how Koreans eat barbecue. I don't know if you know this, Lynn, but what they do, their meats tend to be very thinly sliced. And you grab a little piece of grilled meat, which is marinated in a sweet, salty marinade. And then you wrap it in a romaine lettuce leaf. And you might put some grilled garlic or some kimchi, which is a Korean pickle. And you kind of wrap that up almost mushy style. Dip it in the Asian pear dipping sauce.
Ooh.
And it's great for entertaining.
That sounds really good. The idea of using that lettuce leaf is a nice, fresh contrast.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is there any culture that traditionally grills vegetables?
Well, you find a lot of grilled vegetables in a country that's certainly near and dear to your heart, and that's Italy. Italians are masters of the grilled vegetable. And another culture that does a lot of grilled vegetables is Japan. And I will actually tell you and tell your listeners the single greatest secret I have learned over the last 5 years of studying barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to take any green vegetable, be it asparagus, be it okra, brush it with sesame oil, sprinkle it with salt and pepper, and grill it over a hot fire. And it's one of those 1 + 1 + 1 equals about 16 in terms of flavors.
It does sound, the sesame sounds like it's a great secret.
Well, the sesame, you know, kind of sweet, nutty, and then with the char and the smoky flavor of the fire, it's a fabulous combination.
Hey, Steve, thank you.
Keep on grilling.
We will.
I'm going to travel to the east, travel to the west, stay a little longer in a place I love the best. Then I'll get the urge to be a moving on. Until I get this home and sign and drop my phone, I declare I'm in a traveling mood. Gonna visit all the towns and places. You bet I will. I take you still. I got the roaming status in my mind.
Franklin is author of the Barbecue Bible, Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. You can get his recipe for Korean barbecue sauce. Now, this one has bits of crisp Asian pear mixed with sake and garlic and soy. I mean, this is a dipping sauce to end all dipping sauces. Anyway, you can get the recipe two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org. When you think France, you think great home cooking, right? Of course, right. But when do the French get time to cook? They're working just like us, yet they pull together these fabulous meals for family and company, and, may I add, never look frazzled, are always impeccably dressed, and rarely call in a caterer. There's a secret here, and an American expatriate, Carol Shapiro, has found it. She reports from Paris. I had noticed these blue and white frozen food stores called Picard Les Surgelés when I first moved to Paris almost 3 years ago, but couldn't really figure out what they were. Why would you have a store with nothing else in it but row after row of freezers filled with frozen food? Then I ran into Luce in front of Picard. Luce is everything I am not: chic, blonde, a fabulous cook, and French. She told me she was shopping for a dinner party she was having that night, and when I looked a little puzzled, she smiled and showed me a large Les Surgelés box. There was her dinner: saumon farci au noir de Saint-Jacques, a frozen, fully cooked stuffed salmon, complete with head and tail, pre-cut and arranged on a decorative platter. All you had to do was open the box, stick the fish in the oven, and heat for 50 minutes. I had just had my most valuable lesson in French cooking. Inside Picard Les Surgelés, you won't find paper towels or potato chips or magazines at the checkout stand. Just freezers with little signs that tell you the price of what is inside. Picard started about 25 years ago with one store in the Rue de Rome in Paris. There are now more than 60 stores in Paris and more than 400 all over France.
Alors, justement, l'évolution du surgelé.
Madame Touché is the manager of Picard Les Surgelés in my neighborhood. The first products offered were French fries, pizza, breaded fish sticks, and ice cream.
Maintenant, on vend toujours les frites, le boisson bané.
Now, we still have French fries, breaded fish, and pizzas, but we have so many products that are more and more elaborate that you could find in the best restaurants. Now you can eat good things at home without going out to a restaurant.
I asked Madame Touché who shopped here.
La clientèle Picard, elle est très variée.
The clientele is varied. It's older people, mothers with families, teenagers, and young kids who come to buy ice cream by themselves, people who are busy and don't have the time to cook themselves,
and
just about everyone I know. Sally, an Australian journalist, discovered both the joy and hazards of Les Surgelés when she had to cook dinner for her husband's French colleagues just days after she moved to Paris.
Anyhow, so I've made my entree and made the main course, and I thought, oh, look, I'm just going to get something. Most probably they'll just have cheese and they won't want to have dessert, but no, of course they wanted to have dessert. Anyway, I'd bought this lovely chocolate cake, and it really looked quite splendid, but, you know, I mean, I just thought, oh, I'll just take that out. They won't know anything about it. I walked into the room and plopped it down the table with 10 people all around. Anyhow, they said, oh, this is magnificent. And then this very superior, very chic French lady said to me, oh, I can see you know exactly where to shop. Which I thought, oh, God, you know, she knows where I bought it from even. She knows how much I paid for it. It was quite a shock. But felt pretty good about it, too, because I thought, now I've just entered the elite.
My book group, which meets once a month, is made up of about 16 French women with families and careers. So before we began our last meeting, we had a talk about frozen food.
Oh, Before in France, we spend 1 hour cooking before the lunch, and now in a quarter of an hour, all is done. It's a change of life for a woman.
And each month you have special offers, and you jump in the shop and buy this.
You don't have to think; you just
enjoy the new produce, you know, because they have always new produce and they are less expensive. So I go every month and I choose. And it's less expensive.
So I use quite a lot for my dinner, my very chic dinner.
For the cocktail, pain surprise. And it's very good. You know pain surprise? You have good sandwiches and...
The pain surprise, which means bread surprise, looks like an enormous loaf of bread. When you remove the top, voila, the surprise. Little perfectly cut triangle sandwiches of jambon de pays, mousse de canard, saumon fumé, and mousse de roquefort noir. All with no crust and arranged to look like you have spent hours preparing it. I served it the next time we had some friends over.
Was that frozen?
That's my husband's hand. Yeah.
You mean the sandwiches were frozen? Yeah. It's incredible.
Are you kidding? It's perfect. It's the perfect solution.
And that's my friend Christine.
This is the answer. This is wonderful, well-prepared food, tasty food, attractive food. You can lie and pretend that you made it because it doesn't look like some sort of tray of frozen dinner. So it's perfect in every respect. I loved it.
Tonight we are having navarin de la mer with a sauce chablis. First, I open the freezer door, take out the bag, and carefully empty it into a large pot. Stir for 8 minutes over medium heat. Et voilà, it's done. Bon appétit.
What is that? Looks good.
Oh, it's a navarin de la mer, sauce chablis. We're ready soon.
I think I'll have a little chablis myself.
This piece was produced for us by Carol Shapiro.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call.
Time to open up those lines for your calls. Phone us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to it. We've got Deborah on the line. So, Deborah, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a bit perplexed as to what the difference is, if indeed there is one, between green onions, shallots, and scallions.
Okay. Part of the answer depends on where you live. Where do you live?
I live north of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay. The key word here is north. Let me explain. First of all, I'll tell you the differences, and then I'll tell you the exception to those differences.
Okay.
Scallions and green onions are essentially the same thing. They're those bunches that you can buy in the supermarket. They have long green stalks and little white ends to them and roots on the end of the white ends. And they're very mild tasting, and generally you use them raw. And they have those two names, green onions or scallions.
Okay.
Shallots look like a very small onion, and they taste like a combination of garlic and onion.
Oh.
But, now here's why I asked you where you come from. Because if you go down south, especially to New Orleans, you'll see recipes call for shallots, and what they're calling for are green onions.
Huh.
They call green, some cooks down there call the green onion a shallot.
But what would I call it?
You would call a green onion and a shallot. But
okay.
but the deal here is the shallot is a member of the onion family, looks like an onion, a very small onion, and it has this really pungent aroma of garlic and onion.
Okay.
And the green onion, you know, it's the scallion. And by the way, scallions are great grilled.
I've never tried that.
Try it, because all you do is, and you use almost the whole thing, just trim off anything floppy.
on the end. And toss it with a tiny bit of olive oil, a pinch of sugar, lots of salt and pepper, and just put them on a griddle on top of the stove or on your grill outside. And they cook in about 4 or 5 minutes and serve them at room temperature with balsamic vinegar on them.
Oh, that sounds heavenly.
It is. You can put balsamic vinegar on anything. It'll taste good.
Okay.
Even ice cream, believe it or not. Hey, thanks, though.
Thank you.
Take care, Deborah.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for trivia. Our trivia challenge this week is a definition in terms. You word lovers should be able to figure this one out. The question is, what is mycophobia? We'll be back in a moment with that answer and more of your calls, so get to those phones. The number's 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour, so get on the line. The number is 800-537-5252. But before we launch into more of your questions, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what is mycophobia? Well, it's a fear of fungus. Well, really, it's a fear of mushrooms. Now, if your mycophobia is about being poisoned by the wrong wild mushroom, fear no more. Just take a look at the markets. We've got all kinds of safe wild mushrooms, of course, depending on the season. Now, two unusual ones to keep an eye out for are the puffballs and the oyster mushrooms. Now, puffballs look, well, just like what they sound like. They're whitish balls with puffy interiors. Now, what you have to know about a puffball, other than it tastes great, is that there are two tricks to getting the most out of it. First, they've got to be fresh, so there shouldn't be any signs of drying or bruising. The next thing is you've got to cook them slow, otherwise they turn bitter. The best way is dice them up and sauté them in butter with a little bit of onion. Now, as far as what does a puffball taste like? Well, it's kind of luscious and meaty, and it tastes a little bit like a white chicken breast. And I know, anything you can't describe, you always say it tastes like chicken, but this really does. Now, the other mushroom to check out is the oyster mushroom. They're gray beige, and they're ruffled. I mean, they really look like ruffles. Now, they're at their best also sautéed, just like the puffballs, or baked in cream. Of course, just about everything is good baked in cream. Then there's the old standby, portobellos. I make them into a main dish with a recipe that you can do right on the grill. It's from a farm woman in Sicily, and it's called portobello steaks with holy oil. Now, to make the holy oil, all you do is puree together garlic, hot pepper, oregano, and a little olive oil. Slather that onto big portobello mushroom caps, let them stand about 15 minutes, and then grill them until they're crisp. They're great hot, and they're good at room temperature. Now, you can get the recipe on our website at splendidtable.org. Okay, enough. Let's get back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Erin's on the line. Erin, welcome.
Hello.
How are you? What do you want to talk about?
I'm doing well, thank you, and I'd like to talk about tahini.
Ah, sesame seed paste, right?
That's right.
Yep. So what do you want to talk about?
I'm sorry, I bought a whole jar of it to make some hummus, and it really helped out my hummus, but now I have a whole jar of this really expensive tahini paste. So
Yeah, this is always the problem. You buy that one ingredient.
Right.
You know, and then, but there's great stuff you can do with tahini. The first thing to know, just to get other ideas, you know, of what to do with it,
mm-hmm.
it comes from the Middle East. So anybody who's written about the Middle East is going to have recipes like Paula Wolford or Claudia Roden. Those are two people who come to mind anyway. But there is a great sauce that you can use for grilled fish and grilled vegetables.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, you just take the tahini and you thin it with a really generous amount of vinegar. So if you've got a half a cup, let's say, of tahini, you might use 6 or 7 tablespoons of vinegar.
All right.
And then you add diced onion to taste, salt and pepper, and you can throw in some fresh coriander if you like coriander.
Oh, that sounds great.
And then you just dip into that, you know, with your grilled fish or your grilled veggies.
Oh, that's outstanding. We're having fish this evening.
Well, it's great. It's delicious. The other trick is, by the way, store the tahini in the refrigerator.
Oh, good. That's what I've been doing.
Good. Yeah, because otherwise it can go sour or stale.
I was wondering.
Yeah, but try that sauce. And the other thing we do is we buy pocket bread, you know, the pita bread,
mm-hmm.
and we just sort of dip the pita into that.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a bad thing.
Oh, it sounds terrific.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Hey, great question. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. The Middle East is one part of the world that's really getting overlooked. With all the attention that's paid to Italian food and Asian food, there is some great eating from that whole area. Do you know one of the oldest and most sophisticated cultures in the Mediterranean was the Arab culture? And one of the oldest cookbooks in print was first put into print in the 1100s in Damascus. The recipes make your mouth water. I mean, things like lamb cooked with dates and cured lemons, you know, preserved lemons that are preserved in salt. So you've got this sweet, salt, meaty. Hey, just check out Middle Eastern cookbooks. Look for Paula Wolfert. Look for Claudia Rodin. And I would say almost anyone else that's covering the Middle East, you're going to find some really good eating. Rick's on the line. So, Rick, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I had a question about food storage. The roasted bell peppers are so expensive in my area that I like to store them, roast them, and red bell peppers need to be stored for a while, but I don't know how long before they would be contaminated. I kept mine under some olive oil, and I called a while back to find out what you might think about it.
Well, I'll tell you the good news and I'll tell you the bad news. Let's start with the bad news first so we can get it out of the way.
Okay.
Never store anything under olive oil for more than 24 hours because there are a lot of spores and little bacteria that are sitting there waiting to blossom that can cause, that are really botulism spores. And what happens when you get botulism is that most people have one reaction to botulism, and that is they die. So you really don't want to fool around with this. And the idea is botulism flourishes when there's no air. So don't put them under oil, unless you're going to keep them for like a day in the fridge.
Right. Well, I was storing these for an extended period of time. I'm glad I haven't dropped out yet.
I'm very glad, and I wouldn't dip into anymore. And the other thing is don't feed them to little ones, because little ones are really susceptible. You know, their systems don't have some of the resistance our systems have. But what you can do, one of the basic things about storing things like peppers is if you put them in vinegar, because acid tends to kill off a lot of harmful bacteria, you can keep them for a week or two in the fridge. The other thing, though, you can do with them with oil or vinegar is freeze them. Now, they'll break down a little, but then you end up with either very soft roasted peppers or the greatest puree you've ever tasted because it tastes real sweet.
Great.
Yeah,
great.
So that's the way to do it. And as far as just basic stuff, you know, about how long does stuff generally keep in the fridge? If it smells bad and it has anything furry on it, you know, you don't want to eat it.
Sure. If it looks like little animals, take it out and throw it away.
Exactly. And if it's moving on its own steam, you don't want to eat it. But there is, just going back for 1 minute about this business of putting things under oil, that's a case where you don't smell it, you don't taste it, and you can't see it. But it can be really deadly. So nothing stored under oil more than 24 hours.
Great, Lynn. Interestingly enough, I'm calling you from Sullivan College in Louisville at a culinary school.
Oh.
You just helped me on my pop quiz.
Oh, this is great.
No, seriously, I was a builder for 21 years, and I just left the business, sold the business, actually, and I've started culinary school. So
do you want to be a restaurateur?
I believe that's the objective of the whole thing.
You realize you gave up a relatively sane and you know, really profitable business for something that may not be either one of those two things.
I understand. I understand that completely. you've never walked the walk of a builder, so you can't say how sane it is. But
anyway, I guess you're right. I've just paid builders. That's the only thing I've done.
Well, I've got some restaurant experience, and cooking's been a passion for so long that I decided to jump into the fire and, so to speak, and see what I could do.
Well, hey, good luck, and I'm glad we could help you with the pop quiz.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care, Rick.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. We have Donald calling. So, Donald, what's on your mind?
Apart from food?
Let's start with food, and then we'll move forward from there.
Well, I am a devotee of your program. Distinct pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I'm very flattered, sir.
All right. And my question is, how do you make veggie burgers?
Oh, okay. Okay, generally a veggie burger is made from a bean base. You know what I do? Do you know what falafel is, Donald?
I do.
That, I think, is kind of the place to begin, because the idea is falafel is crushed chickpeas.
Right.
Right? Now, do you mind if there's egg in your veggie burger, or do you want to avoid the egg?
As long as it's not on my face.
Oh, okay. Because you can, if you crush up black beans would be delicious. Chickpeas you could do. You could do a mix of things. And you can bind it with a little bread that you've soaked in milk or water. Some really tasty bread, though. Or you could bind it with a little bit of egg. And then I'd start with, let's say, 2 cups of some kind of soft bean that really tastes great. I'd use 1 egg. And then I'd use about 1/4 cup each of things like chopped fresh coriander, chopped fresh, basil. I'd have 1/4 cup of minced onion in there. Certainly garlic. I mean, you cannot do a veggie burger without garlic, right? And I would mix this up, and I would taste it. Put the egg in last, so that way you're not eating raw egg. And when you got the seasoning where you wanted it, for me personally, I would love cumin and coriander, you know, dry coriander as well as fresh in there, and maybe some lemon. And then I'd add the egg to bind it together, and then I'd make, you know, little patties. And I guess the key here would be, don't cook it too fast, because if you're using egg, you want to cook it through.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get it really hot in the center, so I'd have your heat at medium, put a little olive oil, little film in the pan, brown it on both sides, lower the heat, and let her rip.
Sounds divine.
Well, you know, I mean, just think falafel, which you can get a recipe in any Middle Eastern cookbook.
I have some here.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
All right.
Great to talk to you. Great to talk to you, too.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. We came across a new program. Now, this is a deal that actually gets you into the kitchens of top chefs in France and the United States for cooking lessons. The American director is Annie Jacquet-Bentley, and we've got her on the phone. Annie, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Annie, how does this program work?
The program is 1 week long. Well, it's a shorter week than 7 days, usually 5.5 days to 6 days, the work week for the restaurant. When the restaurant is closed, obviously, the internship stops. But they start in the morning. They go through the lunch service, usually have a break in the afternoon, and go through the dinner service. What is really quite exceptional or original about the program is that, you know, it's the first time that those very well-known chefs open their doors to the public. And they really can see and learn and observe what's going on behind the scenes, which is a total different experience. It's not only a cooking experience, but it's also really a cultural experience, especially when you go to France and you see people that are in relentless pursuit of perfection every minute, every second. So it's a very interesting experience.
Well, you're doing this in the United States as well. Who are some of the chefs in the United States that you can go and study with?
I have, in New York, I have Daniel Boulou. Mm-hmm. I have Jean-Georges Bonjerichten, which kind of speak for themselves.
Yes, I think they do.
Know them. Eric Ripert from Le Bernardin. And I have a very talented pastry chef, too, in the name of François Bayard, who is incredible.
Well, for folks who don't know these names, these are some of the most highly touted chefs we have in the country.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And they're also wonderful people. I have one chef in Washington, Michel Richard,
mm-hmm.
one chef in Philadelphia, Georges Perrier, and very recently Thomas Keller from the French Laundry. Yes, he's not well known either.
No, quite a lineup.
Yes.
But let's go to France for one second. The thing that interested me when I was reading about this program is that the French chefs are opening their doors to Americans who are going to be their students for a period of time. Does this mean that the French finally are taking our interest in food seriously?
Yes, they are. Yes, I mean, the French, I think, are finally realizing, the French chefs, that they should, you know, it's not just an inner sanctum. They should open their doors to not only the public and mostly the American public, though I have interns from all over the world, but also open their doors to other chefs as well from other countries and share ideas. And they all have told me time after time, which is quite surprising, that they learn a lot from my interns. And I'm talking about amateurs, because they are quite stunned by the degree of commitment that my interns have.
Interesting. Are French people signing up to study with French chefs?
Not that many, but, you know, I really feel, I'm French, I've been here for 20-some years, almost 30 years, and I really feel that things are switching, and Americans are more serious about food in a lot of ways than French. So, you know, it's switching. A lot of French women now don't cook. They buy frozen food. I mean, you still find wonderful cooks in France. I don't want to say that. But the new generation, the kids, the 20-year-olds, don't cook that much. Where I think here, you know, it's starting. And I've had interns that are 18, 20, 22. I've had young interns. My youngest intern was 16.
Hmm.
So it's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, things are switching a little bit.
Well, Annie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Annie Jacquet-Bentley is a French restaurant consultant and the American director of L'École des Chefs. For information on the classes, go to our website at splendidtable.org. Well, the time is gone, guys. I want to thank you all for joining us today. Have a great week. And remember, you can call us anytime at 800-537-5252. Our answering machine loves the attention. Let me leave you with a bit of wisdom from Oscar Wilde. He said, "Moderation is a fatal thing. Nothing succeeds like excess." Splendid Table is brought to you by the home area at Target, where you'll find professional-style barbecue tools that feature genuine rosewood handles and stainless steel tangs. Target has the selection of barbecue tools you'll need for the grilling season. Information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.